Now, our topic today is modern work and human meaning. And this is one of the issues that is raised by the recent pastoral letter on the United States economy by the National Conference of Catholic Bishops. This was a process that started in 1981. A committee of five bishops, headed by Archbishop Weakland, who is in Milwaukee. And over a series of years, they conducted a number of hearings. The letter went through three drafts before a final draft that was approved by the National Conference of Catholic Bishops in November 1986. And it's been published in a little paperback. The earlier drafts of the letter were published on newsprint or in much not quite as finished form. Now, since have any of you been in either of the other two sessions? A couple of you have. Well, let me just review a bit to sort of set the context for this discussion. What the bishops are calling for is for the United States, the people in the United States, to begin to establish some ethical criteria by which we judge our economic order. Now, the typical standards that we use to judge whether our economy is good or not is how the stock market's doing. You know, you look at the Dow Jones averages, which would the NBC and CBS will give you every evening. Or we look at the gross national product, which is the total sum of all the goods and services that are produced in this country in a given year. And if you plot this on a graph, and that's going up pretty steadily over years, then your economy must be fairly strong. Or sometimes we judge it in terms of the average annual income, or the rate of growth of the economy. Sometimes there are other indicators. If unemployment comes down, for example, you know, that's the sign of a healthy economy. Now, what the bishops want to say is that we need to be aware that our economic order, our policies, our structure, our assumptions, affect human beings in ways that are not clearly indicated in these kind of mathematical models. For example, it might be that the gross national product is going up, but it may be that these policies that are causing the GNP to go up may have destructive consequences for some people. And if you simply look at the whole picture, or at just some of these indicators, it doesn't tell you anything, maybe, about what's happening to the people at the bottom. And so what the bishops try to do in the first half of their letter is using both biblical references as well as a whole series of pastoral letters that the Roman Catholic Church has produced over the last century, since about 1891, dealing with economic issues. What they try to do is arrive at some ethical norms by which we can try to make some judgment about our economy. And briefly, what they come up with is this, that we need to look at the economy in terms of what it does for the dignity of the human person. Does this particular economic order, do these policies acknowledge and respect and enhance the dignity of each individual human being? Secondly, they make an assumption that some people would regard as a bit controversial. They say that not only are human beings individuals that deserve dignity and respect, but they argue that this dignity of human beings can be preserved and fulfilled only in a genuine community. That is, a community in which we can develop real friendships of love and affection with other people. Now, the bishops call attention to the fact that there are different reasons why people get together. That sometimes people get together in a group simply because they want to make money from each other. So in other words, sometimes a group is not really a community, but it's simply a collection of mutually self-interested individuals. And so what the bishops are trying to say is that too often we have thought of community in this country pretty much in terms of individuals that get together for mutually self-interested reasons. But that's not real community, they're saying. And so, given the fact that we have an economic order that often emphasizes competition, then frequently we find ourselves in a situation in which the people that could become good friends are really our rivals, or they are our competitors for a promotion or for a certain job. And so they're saying, can we structure our economy in such a way? It won't guarantee that we can develop these friendships and this sense of community, but at least it may provide a greater possibility that can happen. The third thing that the bishops mention in these criteria is what they call the preferential option for the poor and the marginalized. Now, this is connected with what the bishops call justice as participation. And the bishops want to say that we ought to look at the economic order and judge it on the basis of whether or not it enables everyone to participate in the group, in the society. And so justice as participation. Now, the bishops would want to say that everybody has an obligation to participate. But there have been a large group of people, the poor and the marginalized, that kind of exist on the fringes, that at least right now don't have the things they need to participate fully. And so they say we've got to develop strategies to enable these people to participate more fully in our society. So one of the big parts of the bishop's letter has to do with focusing on the whole poverty issue. Now, another very important, and this brings us to today, very important element in the bishop's letter is the whole issue of what work means and what employment means. Now, let's begin here in a kind of personal way with a nice small group. How many of you have had an experience of unemployment that was not voluntary? Is anybody, have you been unemployed and it wasn't because you simply chose to be unemployed? Okay. What happened to you when that happened?
It wasn't for a very long time. Yeah. I was at university, but I was working half time as a secretary, and everyone went on strike. So, obviously, I was thrown into a line. I had to, put in my hours on the picket line, sometimes at 2 in the morning.
Okay.
It only lasted for about 2 weeks. It was in Canada.
Okay.
And it felt kind of, I didn't want to be there.
Okay. Now, were you a member of a union at the time?
Yes.
Okay, so in other words, this was a decision that the union made, even though you yourself opposed or would have voted against the strike? Or?
Yeah, I would have opposed.
Okay.
It was pretty much down the middle. It was real.
Okay. Did being out of work for those two weeks... Okay, and so probably maybe enhanced your anxiety about where the next meal may be coming from. Were you a university student at the time?
Yeah, I was married too.
You were married.
But it was still real. Both of us were
Sure, sure. Yeah. Yeah. I know what it's like to go through graduate school and live on a mere pittance, too. Yeah. Anybody else? There was somebody else that said that.
Yeah, my situation was, it was a job I had before I was planning to go to graduate school. Mm-hmm. It was somewhat of a transition period, so it wasn't like it was a main job that I was planning to have for a long time, but I did get laid off mm-hmm. from the job before that, and I knew I'd be starting graduate school not too long, a number of months away, so I was just kind of riding out yeah. until that started, so it wasn't a real bad situation, but you still have the anxiety and having to go through those lines
okay.
and have them ask you a lot of questions.
Yeah, yeah. Were you married at the time mm-hmm. at this? Yeah. So.
This year will change in self-confidence.
Okay. You saw a change in him. What happened exactly? What?
Well, you know, people expect you to be working, and yeah. everyone's asking, "Have you found a job yet?" Yeah. And when you haven't, your self-confidence
yeah.
really.
Yeah.
Performance, I think that's what I saw.
Okay. What does that suggest about what work means in our society, and how this, you know, we kind of pick up on a certain understanding of ourselves in relation to our work?
It's if you don't work, you're less than full, or you're nobody sometimes.
Okay.
Second class.
Okay. All right.
My situation was, it wasn't that I was voluntarily out of the work. I gone to college, decided that what I had gone through, I didn't want to do. And I got married, we moved to Toledo, Ohio, and I just got a job at a McDonald's
uh-huh.
for the time. I didn't know what I wanted to do, but I needed a job.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that a lot of people, my husband was going through medical school, and you go to these functions and they'd say, "Oh, what do you do?"
Uh-huh. right.
I work at McDonald's, and automatically it's,
oh. Right. Okay. How did you feel when you had to say?
Awful.
Yeah.
I mean, I felt like, oh gosh, yeah. I guess I should be doing something else.
Yeah.
I went to a lunch where this woman asked me what I did, and I told her, and she never spoke to me the rest of that meal.
Uh-huh.
And there were five people at the table.
Yeah.
Gee. And three of them didn't talk to me.
Yeah.
I was like, okay.
Right. Yeah, it probably would have been okay if you'd have been a 17-year-old high school student,
right?
Working there, but to be a college graduate, yeah, this is can often.
Very similar to that. I was working at a church as a youth director, and while he was getting his master's, he was working at the church as a part-time custodian,
mm-hmm.
and a part-time salary. He was making more than I was making as full-time youth director.
Wow.
People thought that was just awful, that he was a custodian.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's somewhat like the McDonald's.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, right here.
I remember I voluntarily decided to take a year off after college, and I remember my husband was working at the time, and I remember going to some dinner function where we were supposed to be together, and someone said to me, "What are you doing to justify your existence?"
Uh-huh.
You know, it was that point.
Right. Uh-huh.
And I said, "Well, I'm taking the year off. I'm just reading. I'm having a good time." You know, and that bothered him.
Yeah, yeah.
But I guess he just captured how he usually thinks of it.
Okay, in other words, he saw you as just a kind of shiftless and a shirker, and that you were just taking.
Or, you know, just kind of going for a free ride.
Yeah.
You know,
okay.
Sort of
okay. Yeah, that's interesting.
But I never heard something just out
and
out and
blunt
to say,
right.
To justify
yeah.
your existence.
Well, this is my wife that just came in, and the experience you talked about at McDonald's, when I entered graduate school, Ann had been teaching high school for several years, and I went to Vanderbilt, and when she had an appointment with the Nashville Public Schools. But she became pregnant in the meantime, and they withdrew the contract. Now, knowing what we know now, probably, you know, we could have sued, and that would But at that time, we didn't really think about it. This was in the late 60s before that became a real issue. And so so Anne, while in the meantime she was pregnant, went to work with Manpower. And we had the same experience of going to these parties and drop-ins, and they'd say, "Well, what do you do?" And she said, "Well, I work for Manpower." One of them was junior pro football, or
the junior pro football league, and an auctioneer for a while.
Yeah.
Interesting jobs in that capacity.
Well, your experiences sort of reflect in a kind of mild way a book, Modern Work and Human Meaning, by John Raines and Donna Day Lower. Raines is professor of Christian ethics at Temple University, and Donna Day Lower is professor at the Lutheran School of Theology in Philadelphia. And they teamed up. Of course, Pennsylvania has been hit very hard by the crisis in the steel industry. And so about the first half of this book is based on interviews with husbands and wives of families in which one or both of the people were laid off, and does an excellent job of chronicling the kind of changes that occurred in their self-esteem, in their whole understanding of themselves, and what happened to the men, for example, when they were out of a job, but their wife was able to find a job, and yet, you know, they stayed at home and did the housework. And some people came through it with a kind of renewed sense of themselves, and were able to weather it. But most of them, this led to a lot of divorces and to child abuse. And so it's a rather remarkable book. It's published by Westminster Press. I don't think it's in the bookstore. Well, what one thing that this experience tells us is that, or maybe hints, is that there's something about being human that in order to be fully human, one needs a creative relationship to the world. You know, one needs something to do. And in our society, a part of our whole national ideology tends to link up our self-worth with how much money we make, with what kind of job we have. I mean, if you work at McDonald's or a custodian, then we don't usually grant those positions as much worth as we do some others. So the bishops are sort of fighting here on a couple of fronts. On the one hand, they want to say that employment, gainful employment, is the most important line of defense against poverty in connection with the whole poverty issue. That it not only provides a means for helping people to have adequate food, clothing, and shelter, but it also is very important in helping people to feel a part of the community. I mean, participating, just as participation. And so when one is unemployed, you're sort of hit by a double whammy. On the one hand, you can't provide for your basic material needs. And the way our welfare system is set up, simply standing in the line to apply for food stamps or whatever can be very demeaning. We live in an area where there are a lot of rural poor, and it's not at all unusual to get behind a family in the supermarket that is buying groceries with food stamps. And it's interesting the way they are treated. Sometimes they're treated very nicely, but other times there is a a sense that, boy, we are really doing you a favor to let you come by these things with good sense. So you've got the, you know, the whole issue here of if you're without a job, you are put in the position of having to seek out welfare, which the way it's structured now can be very demeaning. And secondly, it one according to Raines and De Lore and some of your own comments, you begin to lose self-esteem and almost begin to think of yourself as responsible for your own unemployment. This is one of the striking things that these writers found, how the people tended to think that they themselves were responsible for not having a job. Even though U.S. Steel suddenly came to the plant one day and said, well, we're going to lay off 1,500 people. You know, that the way our national myth is structured, that if we don't have a job, we feel like we're really somehow responsible, and we kind of push ourselves out to the margin and do not participate. Now, this kind of raises a question. What are the various meanings that are attached to work in modern society? Now, what kind of meanings do we attach to work? Let's see if we can jot some of these down.
Do you mean like why we work?
Yeah, why do you work?
To make money.
To make money, all right. Now, when you say to make money, do people work simply to just make enough money to for the basic necessities? Or,
to buy things, lots of money.
Right.
BMWs and
the
hot tubs.
Do what?
BMWs and the hot tubs.
BMWs and a hot tubs. I must admit, I have this lust after BMWs and Mercedes.
Neither of which we
have. To make money, buy lots of money. Okay.
Power and image.
So to kind of, you know, in a sense here, work has to do with, now, not just with meeting one's basic material needs, but of establishing power and image. You could use the word status, okay?
Well, that sounds a little negative. It can also just be security, so that you have enough for your children to go to college.
Okay.
I mean, there's a certain amount of responsibilities.
Okay, so maybe we are overstating the case a little bit, that there is a sense of security in having a savings account, stocks and bonds. And things like
that. Self-esteem.
Self-esteem? Yeah, it, perhaps we should make a distinction between what ought to be acceptable self-esteem and the kind of, you know, sense of power that makes one arrogant, in the sense that one accumulates power and therefore thinks that I'm better than someone else.
Well, see, most everybody works to make money, but not everybody works to make lots of money.
Money, okay.
Some people make a conscious choice.
Choice, that's right, that's right.
Something that they
still need money. Okay, so one, the two writers in this book kind of summarize this whole thing of talking about work as achievement, sort of, you know, individual achievement, that it work is understood almost entirely in individual terms, that it, I'm interested in the money for me or my family, and I'm interested in the self-esteem this will give me, or beyond that, power and me. So this is one meaning.
This relates a lot to the thought of Eric Erickson, the psychologist, who talks about human beings having to accomplish certain developmental tasks all through their life. And for Erickson, the developmental task of middle adulthood, which is between
sort of adolescence and old age is productivity.
Yeah.
And that he's saying it would be more than making money, but yeah. it relates more to what you were saying in the sense of we have this innate need to be productive, to be, he uses the word generative, I think, but to contribute right. to yeah. our society, feel like we are a useful part okay. of our society as opposed to stagnation.
Okay.
And I think that's some of what's going on when people are laid off, because they lose that sense of productivity.
Well, I mean, this. So what we're sort of saying is that there is a sense in which work as achievement fulfills a very real human need. I mean, we have a sense of contributing and all this. Now, it can also become distorted, perhaps, if we see work simply in terms of. Of kind of climbing a ladder that becomes then a way of judging ourselves better than others or something. You wanted to make a comment here.
Well, our view of that, I mean, the need to work is not very societal.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that isn't a worldwide view.
Okay.
So pretty much narrow-minded.
Right. Okay. All right, in other words, you're saying that... that this idea of work is not universal, but it's a cultural kind of thing in our, okay.
And I think Erickson, I don't think, would disagree with that, because he, you know, his talking about productivity is not necessarily what we call work, but it, you know, I relate to it in terms of being a mother, and you know, you have the choice of whether to stay at home
yeah.
or not, perhaps, and I think for the mother who stays at home, or that she needs to feel like she is productive in that role
mm-hmm.
for that to be a good thing to do.
Yeah.
And some women do and some women don't.
I'm not sure that just stays with the female part of the population here, because I have chosen not to work for a couple of years to be home with my children. I'm
right.
not sure I need work to be,
right.
quote, a productive part of society, or the need or the feeling to be a productive part of society. I feel I'm a very productive part of society by being a father at home with my
sure.
children.
Okay.
I've got a unique situation in that both my wife and I are teachers in a district that grants leaves of absences for child-rearing or for parenting. My wife has taken 7 years to be the main parent at home, and I have chosen to take a couple of years off. Now, it might go back to the point where I do have some security in the fact that I can go back to this job whenever I choose because I'm voluntarily taking some time off. But I feel very productive and very secure in the fact that I'm, you know, maybe producing in society by taking care of the needs of my children.
That must be a very enlightened school district.
It's a very enlightened school.
Yeah.
In fact, I took a year off in 79 when our first child was born, and ours was the first district in all of Minnesota
mm-hmm.
to grant a male a parenting leave.
Yes.
And now I've got two more years.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that the role reversal image, a lot of my male friends have jobs, quote,
yeah.
to make money,
yeah.
to make lots of money, power and image, security,
yeah.
and so on that you have mentioned.
Uh-huh.
And whenever we get together, they will say things like, well, how are the soaps? You know, they...
Right,
they,
right, right.
You know, are you watching as the stomach turns, et cetera, et cetera?
Right.
And, or other things, you know, for instance, I went shopping, and an old lady came up and asked if she could help me find things in the store. You know, sort of a...
Right. She
figured you were a stereotype, if you
right.
will. You know, it's really interesting.
That the only reason you were in the grocery store
yeah.
was because the wife was sick or something.
That's right.
Like, yeah,
she was
right.
sick. You know, I
yeah.
didn't know if I could push the cart down there and find the frozen
right.
vegetables and so on. I, you know, they'll ask me how coffee goes in the, you know, if we're having coffee, and the women in my neighborhood are fairly enlightened, and
uh-huh.
you know, they see me home a lot. And
do you get invited to the coffee clutches?
Yeah, sure. I go have coffee. Put on a garage sale with my next door
right.
neighbor, who was a woman,
uh-huh.
and we sat for a couple of days and had a great garage sale.
Right.
And, I am enjoying.
Well, you are a remarkable male.
Well,
I
I'm enjoying it. I must say, and I will be quiet after this, but I must say that not every male could do that or will choose to do that.
Yeah.
But the sad thing about that is they miss so much with the
yeah,
other.
Yeah.
And I have to put a plug in.
Well, this brings me to ask, what has been, I mean, we've tended to identify work as achievement with the male role. You know, the male goes home, brings home the bacon, and achieves power and status and all. And the whereas in our traditional kinds of understandings, the work of the woman has been understood in a quite different way. How would you describe the kind of the work woman's point of view?
Well, I am a woman that works and as a mother, and I have guilt the other way because I mainly through family and friends because I don't fulfill my role in keeping the social network together. I'm not very good at writing letters, at doing social engagements, of making sure I keep up with all the special occasions in the family, and I get this constant guilt from family that I'm just not fulfilling my responsibility as a woman, keeping everybody.
So in other words, the your responsibility then as a woman, how would you say it?
It's kind of keeping the family, the social network. It's extended family.
Yeah, keeping the social network together.
It's not just a matter
of
being a mother, but it's keeping the whole extended family kind of together.
All right.
A social. And that, I suppose, would extend also into how much you participate in the school district and all of those things.
Okay.
I suppose what used to be being a volunteer and a lot of different.
Okay. And you don't really expect to be paid for these kinds of things normally. I mean, keeping the family network together.
Right.
I mean, this is.
It's just assumed that you would do that.
Yeah. You've been pointing to.
Oh, I was going to comment about the man who stays home. I think that's really neat that you can do that. I teach preschoolers, and this particular year I worked at a daycare center, and I saw so many children that both parents worked, and I'm not downing the parents, because I do realize that some they just have to, and it's the way it is, but I did see an awful lot of children who they'd be dropped off 6 o'clock in the morning, they wouldn't be picked up till like 7 or 8 at night. And you could see it in those children. Now, and then the body parents, they'd pick them up, and the children would be up late at night because they would want to spend some time with them. And you just, so I think that's great but I think you have to look at each individual family and see, if both have to work okay. Like, I have a girlfriend who has chosen to stay home with her children. And there again, she sees a lot of people who say, well, what do you do? Well, I stay home with my children. And it's like, so what do you do?
Right.
I don't think that society puts enough emphasis on children, the importance of raising them.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. Kind of coming back here, the word that's often used with respect to sort of the meaning of work for women is work as service. That, a woman is not supposed to go out and achieve in the way that the male is, but, she is to serve. Now, interestingly enough, the people who want to sort of promote this as the basic idea of work would often turn to the parable of the talents in Matthew 25. That, what you're supposed to do is like the guy who got the 5 talents, and boy, you go out and make another 10, and the guy who is shiftless with the 1 talent, you get his 2. Now, I think that is a gross misreading of that parable, but because that interpretation of the parable sort of defines God's interest in terms of my own rather selfish interest, whereas I think it's very specifically a parable of the kingdom of God, and that really the basic thrust of that parable lies elsewhere. But you frequently will see that cited. Now, in keeping the social network together, this is a kind of having and caring for children. These are regarded as a kind of service, but they're usually not accorded the same kind of importance or status that other things are.
And I think you're exactly right, that what we need, that one thing we need and is to go through a rather remarkable conversion of our understanding of what is indeed important, and that we need, you know, school systems that will recognize the kind of thing that enables you to be at home. So, you know, work as service. Any of you ever listened to black spirituals? What's the view of work in a black spiritual? I mean, in the blues. Spirituals too, but in the blues. Is work regarded as a service? Do the black slaves regard themselves as serving? Did they regard this as an achievement?
It's drudgery. Mm-hmm.
It's drudgery. It's almost a curse. And so they would turn to that little passage in Genesis 3, when Adam and Eve were thrown out of the garden, you know, that, boy, from now on, I mean, you're going to live by the sweat of your brow. And so in the kind of black ideology, and in the black blues, work is curse. It doesn't have any meaning. I mean, they're doing it simply because if they don't, they will be beaten or killed. I mean, this is a, so, you know, work for some people is a curse. There's one more sort of view of work in modern society, and this was one that was identified by Karl Marx, and it sees work as a commodity. Now, a commodity is something that can be bought and sold. And writing 120 years ago, Marx talked about how, as a result of the Industrial Revolution primarily, that work had come to be seen as a commodity, simply something to be bought and sold, just like I can sell tomatoes if I grow them, or I can buy milk at the grocery store. It's a commodity. And Marx analyzed this by saying that human beings have a basic need to work, but that what has happened in sort of our modern industrial societies is that we tend to see work as a process instead of an activity. Now, you may be asking, you know, what's the difference between a process and an activity? What Marx meant was a process is something where the real meaning is found only at the end. In other words, if work is a process, then work is simply a means to some end. I mean, it's simply a means to make money so I can go out and buy my groceries or pay for some entertainment and all. But there's no real joy in the work itself. But an activity is something that I enjoy while doing it. In other words, the purpose of doing it is not just for the end result, but it's because the activity itself fulfills a basic need. I get my exercise primarily by cycling. And we live in an area where there are all kinds of nice little back roads that I can ride. Now, the most efficient way for me to get the cardiovascular effect would be to use a stationary indoor bicycle. And we have one of these that we use rather faithfully if there's snow on the ground or if it's raining. And I can get about the same cardiovascular benefit from a good 30-minute workout on that as I can from an hour and a half on my bike. But when I'm riding that stationary bike, that is simply a process. I mean, I'm doing it only because
I want this to aid my heart and keep it beating. Now, when I'm out on my bicycle in the on these little country roads, that's an activity. I mean, I always look forward to coming home to Ann and the boys, but, you know, the real joy there is not getting home and say, well, boy, I finished that workout for the day. You know, the real joy is in the activity itself. So, Mark says that, you know, several things have happened to work, he thinks, over the last two or three centuries. One is that increasingly work is regarded simply as a commodity, that is something to be bought and sold, and therefore we tend to look at work as a process, as a means to something else. One of the pieces of evidence that Marx cited for this idea of work as commodity was a very subtle shift in the way people referred to workers. And that was the fact that people came to be seen as hands. You had your farm hands, your factory hands, your cow hands. In other words, people were looked at simply for their role as a producer or consumer. It's the hand that we use primarily at work. And so Marx says that the that we've come to think of our labor as something simply to be bought and sold. And that rather than work fulfilling a basic human need, we find ourselves alienated from the process. This word alienated, the root there, of course, is alien, which basically means a foreigner or a stranger. And so what Marx was saying is that when you find yourself in a situation when you're simply doing something for the end result, you're really a stranger there. You really don't belong fully. How many of you have had experiences with jobs that were simply a process, where the only reason you did it was for the end result? Okay.
McDonald's.
Okay. In other words, all right. Okay. What about you?
Secretarial jobs in school.
Okay.
Most factory workers, though.
Factory work? Have any of you ever worked in a factory? On an assembly line or something? What about being a janitor? Was that...
that was process.
That was process?
I needed money in the red of school.
So it was... you probably enjoyed some parts of that more than others, and maybe you could structure the day in such a way that might make it more enjoyable. It was basically a process.
The best part of it was another guy was in going to Luther Seminary, and he and I teamed up and did it as a team, and it was fun to do that.
Okay.
And we were both had a good time doing it.
Yeah. Okay, what? Why was it different with somebody than simply by yourself?
Being able to just convenience sake for one reason, just being able to share and leaving for a weekend or something. But more than that was just being able to share in that experience of. Being less than a process, I guess.
They were more into what they were doing when they were talking to when they were working, so they never forgot that they were working.
Okay.
At least that's what I would see.
All right. In other words, there's a... I think this is often the case that a job that is almost unbearable by itself, that if you have a group of people that are real friends, that it can transform one's perception of that. Yeah.
Yeah, but you already know this process, and that's housework.
Okay.
Laundry's a process. The worst process there ever could be. I mean, you know, I don't let my kids wear anything. They have to just wear their swimming suits winter and summer.
Right.
It's a process. 30, yeah. And, you know, And without, like you said, without another person there to share, it's total luxury.
Right.
I just have to continue to think of why I'm doing what I'm doing. Cleaning and doing the dishes and so on, certainly.
For me, I think the epitome of process is unloading the dishwasher. I mean, every day. And, you know, taking those things out and...
it's got to be laundry to me, though.
Laundry? Okay.
It's in that basket every day. Right. Same thing with the dishes.
Right. That's a... one of the things I think about housework is that... It's so repetitive. Whereas in most male, in many male jobs, like if you're a carpenter or something, you build something and it's going to stay around for a while. But I mean, you bake a cake, and the object is for it to be eaten, and so you create, and then it's destroyed, and so there's this tremendous
meals. Like when I cook. And it's gone, and they leave the table and go away. There's not a thanks, Dad, for...
That's right. It's gone.
I've cooked 45 minutes here. We slaved over this stove.
That's right.
So that I don't let them eat, and then they can't wear any clothes.
Okay.
That's probably goes back to what we were talking a little bit about again before, where the male makes the money and... Mm-hmm. The power and the image and the security for the male, because the woman has traditionally done the housework.
That's right.
There is no.
Yeah.
I think if you would have gone to that place and said, instead of I work at McDonald's, I'm a house person or I'm a housewife, and if somebody else alluded to that, well, what else do you do?
Yeah.
And then you just ball up your fist and you hit him in the mouth.
Yeah. That's right. That's right.
There is so much to do.
Yeah.
In the caretaking of the children, and in the,
there he is.
And that is a tremendous process. It's either shared or it's all one person's job.
Yeah. It is so hard to break out of our traditional division of work between male and female. Now, Ann and I have had the advantage of both being college teachers, and one of the perks of that is that we have an incredible flexibility of time. And can arrange schedules and all this, and so we have divided up the household chores. But I have to confess that I still think in terms of I will go to the grocery store, but she's got to make out the grocery list. Mm-hmm. It is so hard to break out of this conditioning that we.
I think how much farther ahead you are than most. And I still say than most males, and the same thing with me. Think how much farther ahead we are in the process of equality with people by doing that. I think there are a lot of males that, number one, it's totally demeaning to go to the grocery store. And I have some friends right now that say, I would never go shop. I would never do the laundry. And in fact, I have a friend that will come home and say, what's for dinner? Uh-huh. And we'll sit down there and drink a beer until the dinner is on the table.
But he's not gonna.
What they miss in life is I can't describe it.
The relationships with the children, the sense of sharedness and all this.
Even I'd say my husband's very liberated, but he has this expectation that when he does something, I'm supposed to jump up.
Right. I know. We want to be stroked. That's right.
If I do, of course you're supposed to.
The whole thing is that he's always healthy. It's still your job.
I have that, though. That's interesting because that's a good point. I've been cooking for a year, and I expect people to sit down and just gloat over that wild rice soup. People just eat it, and then they get up and leave, and they go play. My wife just got a meeting, and then, PTA at night, and I'm left with the dishes, and I'm left with this feeling of total rejection. It's not really that bad, but this is an interesting concept that when the wife is, it's expected when the man... Boy, did you do a nice job on that!
Right. We want all these extra strokes. That's exactly right.
Yeah, that's an interesting story.
Yeah. Well, where did I intend to go from here? my own personal experience with talking about alienated labor, when I had a job in high school in which I packed chickens at a poultry processing plant. And I was right on the end of the line, and 8,000 times a day, on the average, I would reach over here and pick up two chickens from the vet and turn and put them in a box, a crate, on the conveyor belt. And the only thing that kept me going was the fact that I knew come the middle of August I'd be going back to school. But the two people who worked with me, they were supporting a wife, and one of them was supporting a child too. And now this was early 60s, and we were being paid, I think, about $1.10 an hour. And they were making about the same thing. And so every Friday when we got paid, they would head to the bar across the street from Southeastern Poultry Company. And you know, I have to admit that if I'd been in their shoes, that's probably where I would have gone. Because, I mean, just that kind of work just did not contribute to human dignity. Well, sort of returning here to our, one thing the bishops are calling for is this idea of community and vocation. That vocation is essentially a calling. What one is called to do, and that for work to to have real meaning, we need a kind of transformation in our consciousness, that we're so linked here into seeing work almost entirely in individual terms, that what work can do for me in terms of making me secure, of giving me status and power and this. And so what the bishops are calling for is a kind of transformation in the way we think about work, rather than thinking about it in the first instance or the only instance in what it can do for me, to think about it in terms of community. And that if I can see work in terms of how this contributes to a greater good, some kind of communal good or common good, then I'm more likely to find some possibilities of meaning there. Now, we still have the problem that somebody's got to wash the dishes and do the laundry and clean the toilets and pack the chickens. And so the bishops sort of call for what they call taking some risk of experimentation. That there are some jobs that just have to get done, but could we structure our work in a way that that maybe helps to pass some of these dirty jobs around a little bit? In other words, instead of leaving one guy here to pack chickens 8 hours a day, why not pack chickens for 2 hours and then move over and do something else? Now, here at Holden Village, one of the things that is expected of all staff is that one will serve on the dish team. And, you know, this is something that just has to be done. And yet you'll even see Elmer Witt back there struggling with that dishwasher about every fourth day. What the bishops are trying to say is, you know, could we structure our work process in such a way that one has a sense that this is not just for me alone, but it's for the community? And then if we're serious about that, can we find ways of sharing the kind of dirty jobs so that they don't always fall on the same people? Now, it's a lot different when you move from a small community like Holden out to our society. And I know this is going to be really tough. But the bishops give some suggestions like this. They talk about more flexible time schedules, allow job sharing between husband and wife, for example. And they make a strong call for more experiments in what they call economic democracy. And they raise the question, why is it that we tend to limit democracy to our political system, but are very afraid to try this in an industry? And so they point to certain specific kinds of experiments in profit sharing with the workers. I mean, if one knows, for example, that one's going to get not just the wage, but that one's going to share in the profits, then this gives one a greater sense of participating in a whole. And there are some examples now of worker-owned cooperatives that have a pretty good track record in terms of being productive and profitable enterprises. There are not a lot of these. But the main difference in a worker-owned cooperative is that the chairman of the board is responsible not to the stockholders, but to the workers, who are the stockholder. You know, they realize that this is not going to be an easy kind of thing, but they're calling for some experiment. Look, we've a couple final comments, and then we'll head over to them.
Yeah, corporations are moving that direction. America West Airlines, for instance, out of Phoenix, Arizona, every employee is expected to be able to do the whole of the jobs that are available on an airline, from loading the baggage to selling the tickets to being the host or hostess on the flight, to cleaning the washrooms, to stocking the shelves.
Fantastic.
And they rotate.
They're also
profit holders or shareholders.
They're shareholders in that, okay. And I take it it's a productive, profitable enterprise. Yeah.
Airline, yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
I ask a question about that. Is the company then train each person to do that? So that do you have to come in with a certain level of experience or background?
Not necessarily. You just have to go through a fairly long training process. So you've gone through all the job. Yeah. So there is that. Yeah. There still is that distinction between the pilots and everybody else. But everybody else in the an employee does all the jobs. The expectation being that when anybody comes along, seeing something out of place or need attention, they do it. Mm-hmm. It's not someone else's job.
Job. Yeah. Very good. I had a job back in college with Digital Equipment Corporation, which is now one of the larger computer companies. And this was when it was in its infancy in Maynard, Massachusetts. And I remember one day, I mean, I was just sort of worked on the assembly line. And I remember one day at the loading dock, the president, Ken Olson, who had the genius to develop the first little module computer, and that really made digital what it became. He was down there with his sleeves rolled up and his shirt unbuttoned, unloading truck. And, you know, just that one example was a kind of morale builder. And then there was one other instance where it was one particularly hot day where there was a shortage of power in the area because of all the air conditioners running. And Olson's office did not have any windows, but he would not turn on his air conditioner because the other people were not permitted to run theirs. And so, I mean, he was in this sweltering office in 95 degrees. So, I mean, just some examples of, executive office. Look, our time is up, and if you want to discuss this anymore over dinner or something like that, I'll be pleased to do it. A lot of stuff we didn't get to, but you don't have to take a final exam. So. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.